Preparing to delve in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Delve. My name is Nathan.
And I'm Alex.
And on this week's episode, we are actually going to dig into subclasses. But before we do, I wanted to make a little bit of a plug and an announcement for this upcoming weekend to let people know that if you love to watch me suffer through an anime dating sim...
Oh, we do.
Your wishes are going to be answered yet again, because I have agreed of my own volition, this is all on me, to play Lovers of Aether this Saturday night at 9 Eastern. Hey, if you want to watch me suffer, you just pop on by our Twitch channel. I'm probably going to be in Discord as well, and chatting with some of our friends over there. Hopefully they can give me dating advice.
Because we all know you need it when it's an anime dating sim.
I even when it's a game, I need all the advice I can get. So, hey.
Or just life.
Yeah, it's great. And, hey, you know what? They can start, taking bets on who they think is the most lovable anthropomorphic animal from Rivals of Aether to date.
I hope it's a Bulbasaur.
Well, it was always going to be a Bulbasaur anyway, but, anyway, look forward to that. And with that said, I wanted to talk this week a little bit about subclasses. We didn't really ever do an episode on subclasses, did we?
I don't think so. We did classes a bit, kind of, vaguely, I believe.
Yeah, we did an episode that was getting classy, so I guess this is getting subclassy. sounds right.
Classy on the side, maybe.
So, yeah, classy on the side. There's a good one.
It's my side class.
It's my side class. So, having gotten a little bit more into D&D and being able to play that, that is a system that definitely does use subclasses.
I mean, there are other systems as well,
right?
But this is the one you're familiar with.
This is the one I'm familiar with, just because it's one I'm playing in actively right now.
And to be fair, the subclasses in D&D are actually just the archetypes for each class, but they are essentially subclasses, so we're going to use that terminology.
I have seen systems that don't use them at all. Like, your character is your character, and you just build it up as
yeah, there's a lot of those, too. Subclasses, yeah. D&D 5e added, I think, as a way to differentiate different characters of the same class.
That was kind of what I was getting, is that, like, when you ding at, like, level 3, I want to say it's level 3 for everyone.
Depending on the class, yeah, it's 2 or 3
might
usually.
Might be 2 for some of them, but that there's a point where you then have to choose an archetype or subclass or whatever you want to call it. And that's when you kind of modify what your character is going to be.
Yeah, you basically choose a life path or a class path.
You choose a class path. You know that you've gone down this road, but now it branches. And which one of these branches do you want to go down?
What type of rogue are you?
Right, exactly. My first question to you, though, is actually just a general question. Do you like that kind of character progression?
I do. I wasn't used to it at first because I'm used to more 3.5, for instance, for D&D, where you just kind of... It was a very different system. It was similar, but it was very different because you built up your character's skills, for instance, and feats. So it was really customizable in the way that you could take and pick different feats for different characters, and they would all be built differently but similarly because they all had the same progression. It was just different ways of progressing. It's like you can all level your Skyrim characters up to 50. They are just different in what their skills are by 50, depending on how you play. So it was interesting at first, and I do like it. It took a little bit to get used to that difference in how you your skill points work. Because there are none in 5e, your proficiencies work. And then the lack of feats in 5e is really interesting, but they worked in a lot of that stuff into the classes and the archetypes.
Yeah, I do know that, like, in more recent installments of 5e, though, they've started to put a lot more feats back in that you can use. So it feels like maybe they're having their cake and eating it too, because now you can have feats and you have subclasses, so maybe you get a little bit of everything. Yeah, I was kind of hit or miss on it at the beginning, because I was like, okay, I get to play a rogue, or I get to play a monk, and then at a certain point they're like, but what kind? And I'm like, oh no, choices. Now I have to make a choice, and it's going to affect my character forever.
Hooray!
Yay! And I have seen other systems, and I have played in other systems, Open Legend is the one that springs to mind right now, where basically you make your character, and your character is whatever it is, and you can take new abilities and feats as time goes on, as you level up.
I know in, like, Warhammer Fantasy role-playing game, the older editions I played, it was, you start your character as a job class, essentially. And then you progress through your job class, and the things you take as prerequisites to moving into another job class, and it ever branches, so you move from job 1 to job 2 to job 3 to job 4, but you can choose different ways of doing it. So depending on how you build your character in that sense, you can go from like a soldier to a veteran soldier to a knight to a cavalier or something like that. Okay. Or you could do completely different ways. You could be like a soldier to a marksman to a, you know. There are different ways to branch it, and it depends where you start and where you want to go. You take different things to get there.
Yeah.
That's a totally different branching system, though.
The other thing is, like, I cited Open Legend. Open Legend actually doesn't have classes to begin with.
That's true. You can have subclasses, but no class.
If you don't have classes, you really can't have subclasses. You just have characters with abilities. So it's very open-ended in that way. When we get to subclasses, too, I've seen people that multi-class, right? You have one class, and then you move to another one.
Yes.
But could I just do multiple subclasses?
Of the same class?
Of the same class. Like, I want to be a monk, but I kind of want to be a way of the sun and also a way of a shadow monk.
So I was kind of thinking that not that long ago while we were talking about doing this. I was like, I wonder if you're allowed to do that, because I don't know if rules as written let you do that. So my take on that is, depending on your dungeon master, you could argue that I'm a ranger, but I want to learn from a different ranger. So I've gone one path, but I want to find a new teacher to teach me the other path.
Mm-hmm.
Could I do that as a multi-class character, gaining new ranks in ranger, but starting at level 1 and gaining the stuff from the other set? I think the only issue there would be... Well, it's not even really an issue, actually. I was going to say the only issue would be is you'd gain those perks as if you were that level, but that's not true. If you went ranger and then you went back, it started as a level 1 ranger of the other path, you would just count your ranger level as the total level of your character. So instead of, say, you're ranger 3 and then you go back to ranger 1, you'd still count as a 4th level ranger.
Okay.
Because all your class levels are in ranger. So I think you could actually do that. Like, I don't know if the rules specifically let you, but I don't see an issue with it, because it's just your effective class level in ranger.
Yeah,
all of your levels in both of these archetypes.
It feels like we're getting into some crunchy territory here, but that's okay. Because I'm starting to think, like, yeah, what would happen if I was multiclassing and I was literally a ranger-ranger hybrid?
Honestly, Ranger Rick. They did things like this before, I believe. For instance, your animal companion for rangers before would count as a druid animal companion of X levels lower than your ranger level.
All right.
But you could take things to increase that, for instance. So I think you could do it. It would just be you're taking your class level. So your ranger 4, whatever way, or a monk 4, a way of the shadow. And then you start monk 1, and you take it the other path that you want to, the path of the elements, way of the elements. So instead of being monk 4, monk 1, you would be total counted as a monk 5.
Okay. Yeah, because what I was trying to figure out is, like, if I imagined, like, I had my monk and I got up to level 3 and I said I'm going to be Way of Shadow, and then I say, but now I'm going to go back, and then when I get to level 6 of my overall monk level and I choose a different subclass, I would just get the starting benefits of each of those subclasses.
Yeah, you would get the benefits of the third level, the beginning stuff of the Way of the Elements Monk for that instance, as well as your benefits for the Way of the Shadow. So you wouldn't gain the sixth level benefits for Way of the Shadow.
Right.
Because it requires you to be sixth level in that specific archetype.
Right.
But your overall, if it was a general monk thing at sixth level, for instance, like if your flurry of blows increased or your AC or your speed increases at an overall monk level of six,
yes,
and it's not the subclass variant that's doing it, you would still get those.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Would I still get my overall monk benefits, even if I'm not getting my subclass?
Because your total level is the combined of all your levels, and all your levels are still technically in monk.
In monk, right. And if I remember correctly, because I play a monk, I think and like sixth level, your unarmed damage goes up.
Yeah, so you'd be a level 3, level 3 monk with level 6 monk damage and all the special abilities a monk has, but you'd only have the abilities for the archetype you took of being third level in each.
I would still be like a sixth level monk, but I would be like a baby starting Way of Elements and Way of Shadow monk.
You'd be a sixth level monk, but you would not have the benefits of being a sixth level in any one of those schools of monk.
Yeah, see, I have really never seen that done, and I don't know if it's just because the rules start to get a little bit abstract, like, because they never really, I don't think they ever really described what you would do in that situation.
I don't, as I said, I don't think rules as written it's meant to be done that way, but I see no reason that it can't be done that way. For instance, if I want to be a an assassin swashbuckling rogue, I see no reason you cannot be both an assassin and a swashbuckler.
That would be terrific.
Because you could be an assassin pirate.
Yeah, that would be terrific. Yeah. No, I kind of want to be, like, maybe I want to be a swashbuckler because I want to be a little bit better in melee, but I also want to be a scout so that I can literally travel across the world in 5 seconds. Maybe I want to do both of those things.
I mean, yes.
That's something that we might do if we actually had same class, but different subclasses. Here's the other thing I'm trying to figure out when it comes to subclasses. As far as I can tell, and this is just from my interpretation, there are subclasses that will support the basic function of your class, and then there are ones that kind of diversify from it to give you more versatility. Like, you'll have ones, if you have a fighter class, for instance, like a barbarian, there are going to be some subclasses that make you better at hitting things really hard. There are also other ones that start to almost get you into some spellcasting territory.
Yep.
Do you see a particular benefit between using your subclass as something to make you more versatile or to really go heavy into your specified skill set?
I think that's actually the point of them. It's to give your character more options.
Okay.
Whereas a barbarian base wouldn't be able to do some of those things. The totem barbarian gets these, like, supernatural abilities based on the totems they have. So you become, instead of just a rager who hits things, you become a rager who hits things, but is also empowered by the spirits of the animals that they are, you know, in tune with in nature.
Right.
On the other side, like, the fighter, I believe one of theirs is the Eldritch Knight.
Yes.
Where they actually get some magic, and that's to diversify them, make them more versatile from just being, I hit things with my sword, to being, I hit things with my sword, but I can also throw some spells at these things, and they are not going to expect that. And that's really fun when you mix those things, because it means you don't have to cross-class. You don't have to multi-class to get those abilities. You can still stay straight fighter, for instance, and also have your spellcasting in there. It may not be as powerful as a wizard or a sorcerer or a cleric, but it's still a guy wearing heavy or medium armor and wielding a shield and a sword who's like, oh, you're too far away? Fireball. I don't know if they can actually get those, but fireball.
It would be awesome. They should call those Inferno Knights.
You know what? New name, new archetype. We're going to make this.
That's an Inferno Knight
thing.
And they're just pyromancers. They're basically knights that studied pyromancy.
Praising the sun.
Yeah, they praise the sun. Congratulations. We already know what your outfit is.
Knights of Solaria.
Knights of Solaria. Oh, man. You know that that's already a homebrew. If we looked it up, the Knights of Solaria, I'm sure somebody's already homebrewed that.
They're probably clerics that just, you know, have the sun domain.
And there's got to be a thing where, like, it's a word of power. Like, when you yell praise the sun, like, the sun that's on your chest just jets out a ball of radiant energy.
You just cast a daylight sun, daylight spell centered on your chest.
Oh, that would actually, you know what? With as many times as I seem to end up in, like, dark cellars, that would be incredibly useful.
Daylight's a really powerful light spell. It pretty much obliterates undead.
I'm there for that, too.
Yeah.
But I do like the idea of having a spell that, like, makes it seem like the flashlight app on my phone is now a weapon.
I mean, Scorching Ray is fire, but yeah, there's other ones that are light-based radiant damage.
If you're in a very flammable area...
Oh boy, you don't know the half of it.
No, I ended up in a cellar that had a bunch of rags attached to the ceiling. Let's just say that Rembrandt is very afraid of street urchins now.
Street urchins? Sounds legit.
Because apparently they can turn into, like, grotesque monsters when the illusion wears off. They try to eat you. There's something fun to learn. Low-light environments are good for me because I'm a shadow monk.
Except you glow in the dark.
Except I glow in the dark. If I didn't glow in the dark, that would be even more useful. But in low-light environments, shadow step all over the place. Go for it. But now, I didn't need to take that, but I did like the idea of... That technically makes me a ninja. That's like the ninja class, essentially.
You're technically a ninja turtle.
I'm a ninja turtle, right? And I only know this because, like, the people at Wizards, or at least Jeremy Crawford, had said, like, there's no reason to have a ninja subclass because the Way of Shadow Monk was supposed to be that. So that's already basically categorized. Now, on the other hand, if you don't want to diversify out, if you're saying, boy, I love hitting things with a sword really hard, I want to be able to hit harder with them, you could go back to the fighter and you could take, like, Battlemaster. Now you have superiority dice, and so you can use that to just kind of like double down on what you want to do. The thing that I'm curious about is, at least in Dungeons & Dragons, you usually get these around second level, third level. Do you think that that's a good idea, that people aren't just getting their subclasses right out of the gate, that they have a little bit of time with their character?
Well, I think most people have an idea of where they're going to take their character when they make it. It's not usual that you're like, oh, well, I'm going to play a ranger. I don't know what they do after first level, but I'm going to play a ranger. So generally, you kind of have this plan of where you're going to go with the character when you make the character. But I think that not having those at first level means you're still all at level 1 and 2, kind of just the base classes. But some of the abilities that start at level 2 and level 3 that you get are also things that you probably don't need at first level, but you probably could have at first level. It's one of those weird areas where there's not a lot of difference between levels 1 and 3, but I don't think it would make much of a difference if you were to say, all right, you get your class specialization at level 1. It's like, I'm a ranger who's dedicated to, you know, giant slaying, for instance, or I'm a Way of the Shadow Monk. You may not have the abilities for it yet, gained? I mean, you could still consider yourself one, I feel like.
This is the one thing that I think about. I kind of picture myself in the writer's room when they're putting this all together for, like, 5e. And they're trying to figure out, like, how to implement these subclasses. And I wonder if there was a thought process of characters coming in at level 1, not necessarily knowing what the campaign is going to be. Like, maybe the GM hasn't specified, or the DM in this case, has not specified what's happening. Maybe they don't know what they're going to get themselves into. They haven't tested the waters yet. The subclasses allow them to kind of modify that if they're not aware, like what's coming up.
I mean, yeah, you can kind of go, I want to play a monk, and then you kind of see which way it's going, and by level 3 you're like, alright, this is going that way, so I want to be elements sound good, because we're dealing with elemental stuff, so I could be able to do elemental jujus and mojos.
I love the jujus and the mojos.
Or you might be like, oh, well, we're going to be sneaky. I need to be a sneaky character.
Right.
So I think it does allow to see where party dynamics are going, and what, like, you would benefit from being, and what you would like to be to help pull the party in a certain direction, perhaps.
Right.
Or fill a vacant part in the party. Or you might have a rogue who goes, I just kind of want to be a swashbuckler or a scout. And you're like, okay, so we need a stealthy person. Because swashbuckler. Because swashbuckler
I would love a swashbuckler.
Really... All right, well, the swashbuckler isn't really a stealthy rogue, so I'm going to be a stealthy. So I think letting it sit till third level does help you with that.
And that's just the thing that I was like... going over in my head, like, if we were looking at this from a designer's perspective, would, like, maybe that was the thought process when they were designing that system, that, like, you know, maybe just not putting it right up at the front, because who knows, maybe you don't know who else is going to be in your party, you don't know how big your party is going to be, maybe you don't have a lot of spellcasters, or you don't have a lot of, like, front and center fighters. And the versatility of some of those subclasses allows you to kind of like rein in how your party is going to form. And
definitely. And some of the classes have a bit better diversity than others, for instance, at least in the base core book. Mm-hmm. I know druids only had like the two archetypes for them. It's the way of the land or circle of the land or circle of the moon. So it's either I'm a spellcasting druid and it's not quite that great, or I'm a shapeshifting druid and I can still cast spells, but I'm also a ferocious animal in combat who has a lot of utility use as well. That wild shape honestly has some of the most versatile usage you can find in a class ability.
There's only two archetypes for druid. For some reason, I thought that there were
there, more. I believe, are only two in the core player, the player handbook.
I'm going to just look at one thing. This might not have been, like, an official thing, but I think that it might have been added in one of them. It was the Circle of Anathema is also listed.
I'm not sure. I know in the other books, they've added more archetypes to a bunch of the classes. Like, Warlock gets... the Hexblade, for instance, which is a really cool archetype.
What does the Hexblade do?
The Hexblade is a medium armor wearing melee based warlock.
Like, warlock that likes to get down and dirty.
The close combat warlock. I actually have one. When you use them with Pact of the Blade, you basically summon a weapon that you can use. And you're wearing medium armor, which means you can wear breastplates, chainmail, scale mail, things like that. And so you get your normal, like, Eldritch Blast and your invocations and your other spell-like abilities and your spell abilities. But you also get to, instead of just being a squishy caster, you get to be almost tanky with melee weapons to boot. And they're magic.
Oh, yeah. So you just do everything real good.
Honestly, it is one of my really favorite classes for that reason, because the character I had made was actually going to be a Warlock Paladin multi-class, which seems weird, but whatever. Because the Pact of the Blade and his patron and whatnot for the Hexblade meant that he, like... worshipped a sentient weapon, essentially. And the background for my character was that, well, the sentient weapon isn't bad. It's, you know, a thing, and it's just a family thing, and his family line is all paladins or warlocks dedicated to upholding this certain, like, rule and this certain kind of code. So they got their warlock powers from the sentient weapon, but they also had a code of honor and rules dedicated to it, so the paladin warlock combination there was really lore friendly for it.
And from that example, I get the idea that when you're picking a subclass, there was supposed to be some story based element to it. Like, there was a reason why you ended up with that subclass, or just in your class in general, but specifically, like, when it comes to your subclass, that there was, like, kind of a story, a reason behind it. I know it's not necessary, but it does feel like a focal point for some of the development.
It can be. Part of the thing there, too, is, like, the backgrounds that you make with your character and that you come up with are part of the story to that. So if your story includes, you would have been this class with this kind of outlook and aspirations for your archetype, you know, that makes sense. But it doesn't have to. Because your archetype could be indicative of just things that happen as you play, Whereas your background to your character is indicative of your flaws, your ideals, and your personality.
Right. And your background is something that you get right out of the gate. So that's just inherent. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's who you were before you maybe started adventuring.
Yep.
Or who you are because you're adventuring.
Those are really interesting, too. At some point, maybe we'll get into that a little bit.
I feel like that's what Stories of the Fifth Age was for, back when that was a thing.
Yeah, but that's not there anymore, so we got to pick up the slack, apparently.
Got to pick up that story slack.
When it comes to backgrounds, which, we won't get into really here, but there are actually some mechanics and some functionality to those, too.
Yeah, usually the backgrounds all have their own specific ability.
You get some bonuses.
Yeah, they're bonuses to their skills and languages and tools that you could have, for instance. But they also generally had a keystone ability that you could use in your games that are kind of like lore friendly.
Okay.
Or affected things like forget the name. One of them made it so that when you're in the wild, you could scavenge for more and find more berries and water and food.
Oh, okay.
Automatically, essentially. Which we don't need to go into right now. We're talking about subclasses, not backgrounds.
But, hey, at some point, maybe we can flesh that out and see the usefulness of it. But when it comes to subclasses, though, something that I've noticed, and maybe this is just because of me, when I got into a system and I was like, okay, I'm going to be playing 5e. I need to understand this. When I've started looking at different characters, I automatically start looking at subclasses and figuring out what I would want to be out of the gate. Like, that's like an immediate thing for me. I start pathing that out.
Yeah, that's not just you. Not just you, Nathan.
Okay. I figure that's a lot of people.
I feel like that is most of the people who are playing D&D.
Yeah.
Like, even my friend Mallory, who really play, like, roleplay heavy, she'll... Honestly, she will take and figure out her entire character's progression.
Okay.
From the get-go. Be like, alright, I'm gonna be level 1 this, level 2 this, 3, 4, up to whatever level. Like,
she knows exactly how it's going.
She'll plan the entire, all the leveling stuff out for the character ahead of time.
Which I totally understand, because that's where my mindset goes the second I start thinking of a character. Like, first thing I'll be like, oh, this would be a neat character. Okay, what class would they be? Now what subclass? How would they evolve? What would they take for weapons? What would they take for proficiency?
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
I think all of us tend to do this to a point.
Mm-hmm.
But there comes times where, like, with my character, my druid, my Hephaestus, I was pretty sure that his growth was going to go just kind of in this one way, but then an event in the game made me question that. Basically, his brother in arms left the party. And so I was at a crossroads, and if we get back to this game, I'm still at this crossroads where I wasn't really sure what this loss would do to this character.
Yeah.
Where he might just continue along the path he was going, but without the crutch of that other person there to help curb some of the more ferocious tendencies in his nature. I've mentioned it before, I'm sure, but I was considering that he had a branching option here where he was either just going to keep going druid, or he was going to branch off and get levels in barbarian.
Oh.
Because.
I see.
He's a Druid of the Moon, so Circle of the Moon, so he's a shapeshifter.
Yeah.
What his flaw was that he is bloodthirsty. That's one of the things that helped us decide that when we figured out, oh, well, maybe he's got this thing where he's like, oh, it's the beast within. Mm-hmm. And then we determined, well, what if that beast within is literal? In which we went, oh, well, you know what? He's a lycanthrope. And he didn't really know it. Because, you know, it happens. You don't remember that typically when you black out.
No.
It's until you get control over it, then you know it.
Yeah.
So we went, all right, so he's bloodthirsty. He has got this flaw for bloodthirst. He's got this thing where he's got the beast within. And then we go, he's a lycanthrope. So this totally makes sense for the character to have this.
Right.
And totally makes sense in game and in the background for the character. And it was also a really fun surprise to the other characters when suddenly I turned into an albino were-tiger.
Were-tiger, yeah.
So where that character's background had grown to, Like, mm-hmm. I don't really flesh out the full background because things can change. You can decide, oh, well, this makes sense for that to have been a thing. You can figure out some of your background points as you play for reasons that you get into, which is, I think, really fun because it means you're not coming up with a full 16-page backstory to a character ahead of time. Your character evolves by how you play them and how you determine how they are. So we went from, all right, I'm a druid of the moon, I shapeshift, and it explained why he shapeshift really well, because he had lycanthrope blood. He is a were-tiger. So it went, all right, so he's got this feral nature, he's already a shapeshifter, already a lycanthrope, and this character that he was leaning heavily on as a friendship and, like, as a brother and a mentor character, mm-hmm. has left the party suddenly. I was really gripped with, I don't know which way this character's gonna fall.
Right.
He's either going to really succumb to the aggressive nature that he has harboring inside him, or he's gonna keep that, you know, the thoughts of that person and the lessons and just kind of grow into a better person. And I was actually really considering going the feral route because I thought it would be more interesting. So where my character was all like, oh cool, druid, and then all of a sudden, bam, I was like, oh well, it would make sense now if he were to go like a psychotic raging barbarian, mm-hmm. at least for a couple levels to get the rage, because that would make sense. Yeah. So you can plan out your characters, but then events in the game might affect the choices that you thought were pretty much going to happen no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to happen, I suppose, best laid plans, you know, there are going to be external circumstances, and at the end of the day, role-playing is, in many ways, a storytelling exercise, so that is going to influence choices.
And plot twists are fun. So what do you mean you're not just a druid, you're also a raging maniac, but that's bloodthirsty?
I mean, for me, right now, it's that, like, Rembrandt is a monk, and he has his quarterstaff, and that's, like, his weapon that he was given at Sunscale Temple. So it's the thing that he's used to, and it's the thing that he's good at. But then when we, like, raided this orc camp to save some halfling villagers, we found this Githyanki that I basically smacked to death, because that's what Rembrandt does a lot. And, you know, Dom was like, hey, he has these two, like, really nicely crafted scimitars, and you're not really sure, like, what they are, but, you know, if we were to look at it, like, on initial impression, they'd probably be, like, 2d6 plus 3 weapons each. And I'm sitting there kind of, like, going, maybe I'm not a Donatello, maybe I'm a Leonardo.
Here's a question for you, Nathan. Did you take those swords?
Oh, yes, I did definitely take them. I took the swords before I knew what they would be, but I haven't actually found out, like, what their stats are.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I just wanted to know if you took the swords.
Yeah.
No reason. No reason at all, Nathan. Have fun with that.
I did pick them up, so...
Yeah, you have fun with that down the road with those swords. You keep them. And enjoy the damage they do.
Yay.
But I'm going to have to ask Dom something later.
Okay, that sounds fine. Like, you know, Rembrandt sees things and he picks them up. He hasn't decided,
that's
like,
fine. That's fine. That's what you would do. It's what your character would do.
Yeah, he would see something. He, like, not intending to, like, not even knowing if he's going to use them or not. Like, he might say, like, oh, here, somebody who needs a sword that's better than the sword you have.
You just hold on to those and use them. They're good weapons.
Okay.
You said they do, like, 2d6 plus 3 or something like that. That's really good.
Oh, yeah, no, that's why I didn't know that when I picked him up, but then he was like, yeah, you can expect that they're probably, and I'm like, well, I guess I'll see what they actually are when I go to a blacksmith and have him look at it and actually appraise them.
Did you do that yet, or have you not done
that? No, because we had just finished the combat, so I don't know yet. But the problem, of course, there is that two-weapon fighting is not a big thing for monks.
They can do it.
They can, but they're really good at unarmed combat. Like, unarmed is really their specialty.
I mean,
so
you can just use one of them.
I could, but it feels like they're a set. I don't really want to break up the set. Yeah, I haven't really decided what I want to do with that. And it always feels like the more I'm thinking about my combat, the less I feel like a shadow monk in general, where I'm stealthy action guy. When you were talking about, like, your movement toward potentially going to a barbarian, that actually brings me up to a question about subclasses there. Because if you were to go down that route, could you imagine a subclass that you picked for your barbarian line to complement the druid one? Like, would you say, like, the totem line for barbarian would make sense for you? Because it might make sense for your druid background?
You know, that would make sense if it was from a sensical point.
Oh, okay.
But the way that that was going to go, he would probably have been, I think it's the Indomitable Rager.
Oh, okay.
Which one of those? He would have been the pure rage one, because that's where that would have stemmed from character-wise.
Okay.
If I was going at it from a perspective of this would be best to benefit my character,
mm-hmm.
I would definitely probably go with the totems, because that makes sense. But where it was, honestly, from a place of just this feral nature and just this rage,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make sense to me. Like, it makes sense, yeah. Like, thematically to do it with a druid, but it makes mm-hmm. more sense thematically with the feral nature to go with just a rage-induced druid.
Okay.
Barbarian.
You're not necessarily looking at your background. You're really looking at where the character is going.
Right. I'm looking at what brought the character to this at that point and okay. what it is going to do to them.
I get you.
Where it's the loss of this companion and just this emptiness and just this feral nature inside eating away at him.
Mm-hmm.
There is no choice in, like, oh, well, I'm a druid, but this path of nature seems like, you know, something I want to explore. It's just kind of, he would devolve into that. It wouldn't be, like, as much a choice as just his natural progression into that state. As an example of a more famous character who's done this,
mm-hmm.
that you might not be familiar with, necessarily.
If you say the name, I might.
Drist Dowerden?
Yeah, the famous drow. Was it Ranger or Rogue?
Ranger.
Okay, Ranger. I was going to say. Yeah, Dristred Warden, yeah.
Nashez Bernan. I forgot part of his actual last name. It was shortened to Dowerden.
Yeah, I remember
because,
that part.
Because Drows. So if you read the original series by mm-hmm. R.A. Salvatore,
mm-hmm.
The first three books of that, well, the first three in chronological order, not when he wrote them, obviously, because that's the Icewind Dale trilogy. The first three books in that series deal with him being a warrior first, a fighter. Then he finds the Onyx Panther figurine, gets that. He goes, I believe, fighter, ranger, and then he goes a level or two into barbarian for when he's exiled himself from the drow. But he's still underground and basically fighting for survival. If you look at the Forgotten Realms 3.5 sheet form, he actually is like only three levels of ranger, three or four. It's enough to just have the animal companion.
Mm.
He's a bunch of levels of warrior or fighter rather, and he's got a couple levels in ranger. I think he's like 10 level fighter, four levels in ranger, like two levels in barbarian. And then he has his drow character level adjustment, which is what they had in 3.5. So he's like a CR18 character. He didn't really choose that. It's just how he had to survive. He became savage in that environment. So it was a product of the conditions he was in that he became a barbarian for that. Thought process of, I'm going to rage.
I wanted to ask you one other big question about this, which is usually a question that we ask when we're talking about something specific in design, is what a system without this looks like, because there are plenty of examples, but how would you design if you weren't designing for subclasses? Like, how would you design a class system knowing that you didn't want to go down specifically a subclass route? What are some other things you could do?
I think in lieu of the class route system and the archetype system, you could offer different options at different levels.
Mm-hmm.
So where you would normally get these features, and they do this even without the subclasses in there for like ranger and stuff. You can choose your specialization for weapons.
Okay.
And you can specialize in like bow or two-handed weapon or a two one-handed weapons, for instance, dual wielding.
Yeah.
So being, and even wizards specialize in different schools of magic. So you could do it that way without doing archetypes and still offering up different choices at the levels without necessarily the label. But that would mean you can mix and match. So you could be like, all right, well, at third level, I want the rogue's assassinate skill. And then at sixth level, I want like the uncanny dodge thing so I don't take damage from any successful saves on traps or whatever. So you could do it like that.
Yeah, uncanny dodge is great. They actually implemented that in KOTOR, too. Of course, I think a lot of KOTOR, if you look at it, was based off of D&D anyway.
It was. KOTOR is based on D&D, probably second edition, maybe? Second or third? It was based on a D6 system, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it wasn't the D20 system, necessarily. It was really based on D&D. As the system basis, but it was also all the damage was done D6s.
I think your hit dice were still on a 20.
Yes, if you but every other that, dice that you use is based on a D6. So when you're doing damage D6. With your lightsaber, your blasters, it was all D6.
Yeah, and then you would have modifiers. But see, in that game, actually, if we go to that game, it wasn't so much about, like, the level that you hit at, but you did essentially get specializations, mostly by becoming a Jedi. Like, that was one where they said, like, here's your three archetypes at the beginning. You have your scout, your scoundrel, and your soldier.
Well, those were essentially classes, and then later on you would go into your prestige classes.
Right, and your prestige classes in that particular game were what kind of Jedi you're going to be. Are you going to be a Sentinel? Are you going to be a Consular? Are you going to be a Guardian? And you know, again, those are essentially like the stealth character, the magic user, and the straight-out fighter. So you could choose to go heavy on, let's say I was a soldier, so my natural inclination is to become a guardian, because, again, I can, like, do force jumps and go and laser sword people from half a mile away. That would be my natural inclination, but I don't have to. I could also diversify and try something else if I wanted to. And in the second one, they went from the basic Jedi classes to specialization classes in Sith and Jedi. I guess the benefit to subclasses is, and I'm sure this is one of the reasons why they wanted to implement it in 5e, is because it does streamline the process a lot. You know, like, level 3 hits and you choose a subclass and then you kind of know where that is going to take your character past that without a lot of minute customization that you would go through at every level. I can understand that. Because, again, 5e was made to be very accessible. Like,
yes, it was. That way. It is very much an easier system to get into.
But yeah, if you were to look at, like you were mentioning earlier about, like, Skyrim, you don't really have classes in to begin with, really. But as time goes on, you're just
the Dovahkiin.
Yep. And as time goes on, by doing things, you level up different skills, and then you can just become better in those skills. So that's massive customization, like minute customization on the other hand of it.
Yeah, but on that scale, it's hard to do something like that in tabletop. Mostly because the bookkeeping you'd have to keep for leveling skills in that fashion. As in, using the skill levels the skill.
Yeah.
The bookkeeping would not be fun.
I think we discussed that when we went back to talk about experience, the idea of, like, how many different experience pools you would need to do in order, and it's kind of stupid, actually, at that point, trying to make that happen, unless you have, like, a whole lot of, like, math professors in a room that love this stuff.
Math the RPG. It's from Gravity Falls. Probabilitor.
I haven't seen that one, but I'm guessing...
Dungeons, and more dungeons.
Oh, perfect. I love dungeons, and more dungeons. They should have just called it, like, Dice and More Dice.
No. It's dungeons, and more dungeons.
No, they call it Dice Revolution.
Just no.
You knew I was gonna go there. The second you said it. You knew.
Anyways.
Anyway, final thoughts on subclasses? Do you like how they're implemented? Would you prefer different kinds of implementation to develop your character? Or
no, I think they're fine. I think they're good. I think they did a good job with them, and they're well done in most cases, with the exception for the off subclass that doesn't work very well, aka the Ranger in the core book, because they had to basically patch that. Basically, the Ranger in the player handbook, they went, hey, this is really underpowered, so here's this fix to it for free.
Mm-hmm.
I think they really sent some of the Unearthed Arcana stuff. They're like, yeah, Ranger fixes, here you go.
Yeah, at some point, there's a few things that I'm interested that they're bringing back in Unearthed Arcana, and I'm just wondering how useful they are for the modern system, because I know that they were implemented in earlier ones. That's mostly because at some point I want to play an Artificer, and I don't even understand how it works. So there's a lot, and that's gone through a lot of iterations, so I'll be interested to pick your brain at that at some point, but not on this episode. My thoughts on subclasses is that for the streamlining of it that they wanted to do for 5e, it seems to make perfect sense. You know, it allows for more customization of your character without being so laborious to try and micromanage it. It makes sense for that system. But there are plenty of systems, especially that just are more freeform, where that wouldn't make a lot of sense. And so it does depend on what you're building. As we always have a tendency to say, it depends on the system.
It does depend on the system.
I would say that subclasses for D&D archetypes make sense for the system that they built. In another system, might not, but yes. It's something worth thinking about, especially if you've already put down classes in a system. It's something worth considering how you're going to diversify that class as time goes on. So, Alex, if the folks out there wanted to learn more about our subclasses, where could they go?
Probably a dictionary.
Yep.
Or someplace that Nathan goes on to. Yeah. Or you can find us at delvecast.com.
Or Wikipedia. No, you can find us at Delvecast. You can find all of the different subcategories that we have, because we have several different shows that we do over there. And while you're there, why not check out our Patreon? We have some neat stuff for you, even if you're not a patron to our site, like some of our new show ideas that we are kicking around right now. You can find more about More Than Meets the Die. There's a couple episodes up there right now. I know Dom is working on another one as we speak. So go and check that out. See what you think. And for a whole massive dollar a month, you can actually get all of the extended episodes and additional content that we put out there. Make sure to follow us on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, any place that you get your podcasts. Rate, review, and subscribe. We always appreciate that. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter. I am at Citanium.
I am at EXP Limited, and the show is at Dell Podcast.
And so you can get all Twittery about it.
All Twitty.
Yes.
Twitter.
And if you have not seen it yet, please go check out our major announcement about Delve Prime, or the live episode that will be released shortly after this, where we will talk about some other potential Delve Prime projects that we have that were just so much fun to come up with. And believe me, I made cover art for all of it, because I'm that crazy. So again, Saturday I'm going to be delving into another anime. See what I did there? I'm going to be delving into another anime-inspired dating sim.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, you can all enjoy that on the Twitch and everything else, and I'm going to probably be banging my head against the desk by the end of that night. But I don't think it's particularly long, so hopefully I'll be able to make it through.
You'll have to play it more than once, Nathan.
I'll have to play it more than once and see if I get different results.
Yep.
That's great. I want the orca whale looked like it was especially nice, and a character you'd want to spend
Yar,
more time with.
Yar, she blows.
Yar. Until we see you next time, thank you for joining us on Delve, and goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. How do you not want custom Delve skins for your favorite Renaissance sculptures?
Do you have any Renaissance sculptures?
Not that I'm willing to divulge in a public forum,